ANZ Voices welcomes you to the Business of Bloodstock podcast with Tim Rowe and Charmaine Bukovec.
On episode 7 of the Business of Bloodstock podcast, I'm thrilled that Justin Warwick, a bit of an all-rounder from the West, he's been involved in harness racing for decades, thoroughbreds, dabbled in the dogs as well, and hopefully we can touch across all three codes and, as I said, had success across all three pursuits. And Justin joins us now on episode 7 of Business of Bloodstock. Thanks for joining us, Justin.
Good morning.
Now, you've just come from the gym, but you're sort of hands off the horses, so to speak, now, but for a long time you were very much hands on in the harness world.
I had a lot of energy once upon a time, and I trained a lot of horses and did lots and lots of things, and as you do to try and provide for your family and get out off the ground floor. And had a good time. Glad I don't have to do it too much anymore.
Yeah. So what is your background with your family? I believe your father's was a very good trainer and involved in the sport. Is that sort of right from the get-go?
Yeah, look, at the time when I was growing up, I thought I had a pretty tough upbringing, as probably a lot of kids do. And looking back now, I was blessed to grow up where I did. I grew up, my dad was a very good horse trainer. He was one of the leading trainers in the state here in harness, back when harness was a big thing. And the area I grew up in was all horses. So I had Fred Kersey was down the road, went to school with his kids, and another big trainer, Vern Brockman, was down the road, he was the leading galloping trainer, and the leading dog trainer was a guy, old man called Hamer. And he was leading greyhound training. So they're all in the same road where I grew up at the time. So I was exposed to all three codes and we're probably only 3 or 4 kilometres apart.
Justin.
I had a really good upbringing, exposed to everything, taught how to work hard and learned how to do things really well. Or professionally, because Dad was one of the first proper professionals him and Fred Kersley at the time, and obviously then able to build went to school and tried to do other things and tried to get other jobs, but and always ended up coming back to horse racing. It was what I was good at and what I knew more about than any other subject.
So it was a natural sort of progression. Then you were quite a good driver too. From what I read and in researching this podcast?
Yeah, well, when I started off, when you're a young bloke, you don't start off training. Well, I didn't. I was pretty athletic and pretty thin at the time. Things have changed. got the middle-aged blowout, as you do. But I was probably only 70 kilo. I was always tall, but started off in the driving for Dad, and I was probably lucky back in the day. Like, I thought it was tough, and looking back now, no one would do it in their right mind, but we didn't get paid. So we'd go and drive out in the country, and you might drive two or three winners, but you didn't get any money. You had to chase the owner around, put your hand out, see if you could get $100. There was no losing driver's fee or anything like that, and you didn't get 5%. So at the time, I thought it was terrible, but looking back, it was good because the big drivers didn't go there. So the guys, the Jim Schraders, the Phil Kilsons and the Fred Kersleys didn't go out there, excuse me, because you didn't get paid. So what it did, it give us kids an opportunity to cut our teeth and get experience because you weren't going to get paid. So the only person that was going to do it was someone was desperate to put themselves on the map, which most of us were at the time.
What made you switch codes, Justin?
I sort of retired from harness racing. It got really tough. What happened is early doors back in the 90s, say the 94s, 95s, would go to, I was driving and I was a pretty good driver. I beat Chris Lewis once, but that was only when I was training. So I was generally running second or third to Chris Lewis at the time and a lot of country winners. And I started driving for a few trainers that were buying from the eastern states, and they're buying cheap horses, and I mean $3,000 and $4,000 horses that were coming here and winning $50,000 or $60,000, which was a lot of money, obviously, for the outlay. So I thought, well, how long has this been going on? I better get involved in this. So well, I went and flew over to Melbourne, which I had been to Melbourne and Sydney as a kid, travelling with my dad's horses. So I had pretty good connections there with Andrew Gaff, and we were both stable boys at the time, you know, back in the 80s, I suppose. So I had good connections, bought a couple of horses, come back, did well, made a lot of money, I suppose. But then people in WA here, there was a big mining boom, and people started spending ridiculous amounts of money buying horses. And I always used to buy the horses and try and make a profit on the horse. And then with the big mining boom and that here, people had that much money, they were going and buying horses really for trophies on the wall or photos on the wall. And they didn't really care whether they made money or not. And then that just forced the price of horses up too much. And I really couldn't make it add up. So there was a bit of a big boom here in the land, and my farm was worth a lot of money. So sold out, sold the farm, and just went and bought a house down the beach and took a year off. And then I ended up in I got a bit bored, and I bought a service station, turned it into a cafe, lunch bar cafe thing. Don't ever do that. That's the hardest money you'll ever make in your life. Don't do that. Yeah, just stick to journalism. Don't do that. That is tough. So I did that, and then I got I'd had a few I'd broken my leg a few times and had a few knee reconstructions, new cruciates and things like that. And one of the last one wasn't going too well, so I had to go and have an operation to get a couple of chips taken out of my knee. And I got a staph infection in the hospital, or from the operation, just from the luck of the arthroscopy. And so that sort of rocked my world. And obviously, you're in hospital for a while. I was in hospital for a month, can't really remember the month. And then you're in a wheelchair, and then I had the pick line goes in your arm and into your heart. And it really gives you a different perspective on life. So, because obviously you're pretty sick and you got to start again. And I thought, bugger this. While I was sick, a lot of people bought me books and that. So I read Bill Waterhouse's book, Tommy Smith, Bart Cummings, and I was like, right, okay, let's go and train thoroughbreds. So I've sort of got real keen because I'm laying on the couch for months, getting better. So we went and bought a block of land, bought 80 acres in a suburb it's a town called Harvey, which is about an hour and 30 minutes north south of Perth, and started training thoroughbreds. So that's how I got into the thoroughbreds.
Now, I guess yourself and probably Lindsay Smith are known for, I don't know if you're the pioneers of deep sand training, but that's sort of a lot of trainers talk about it now and want to use it. And obviously the Warrnambool sand dunes where Lindsay is now gets spoken about. But you sort of use that training tool for, quite some time.
Yeah. So back when I was freelance driving, Lindsay Smith was training paces, believe it or not. So he had a couple of galloters, and he wasn't doing too well. I think he'd gone way past the wallpaper, through the plaster. I think he was eating bricks. That's how broke he was. And he started training paces. And I remember one of them, his name was Blue Tuesday. There you go. That's a while ago, 30-something years ago. So it's also known as Blue Tuesday. Anyway, I was driving for him, and my dad was driving for him. Dad was still driving in those days. And we become good mates. Obviously, Lindsay's a character. It's pretty hard not to warm to him. And I was freelance driving, so I had a bit of time. And I'd work the horses in the morning. And then Lindsay had gone to a gym in a place called Spearwood. And Lindsay would have been, 30-something, maybe 40 at the time. I can't remember. So he was in his 30s, and we went to this gym, and we met this guy, and he was a bit of a nutcase. He was super fit. He was an Irish guy, and he was super fit, and he trained us. He trained us. Why we kept going back, I don't know, but he got us that fit, and that we literally could have gone in any sport in Australia, I reckon, at the time, and we would have kept up considering we had no ability at any of it. But we were fit. And so we started to sort of improvise this work into our horses, bearing in mind where I live is only sand. So you couldn't find a hard bit of ground to work your horse. You actually had to make a hard track. Where in, say, Victoria or Sydney, you've got to make a soft track. Where we grew up, or where I was, the whole place is sand. So you actually, it was easy to work them in the sand. So, and this little place I had, actually it wasn't even a little place, we were renting these stables because we never had any money or anything. And we're renting these stables, and across the road, this little dead-end street, there was this probably 10 or 15 acres of land that never had a fence around it. And Lindsay used to trot his horse around the boundary, but over the years that it got that overgrown, you couldn't get around it. So I thought Easter was coming up, that's right. So I thought we'll hire a front-end loader and a grader. I think it was, no, just a front-end loader then. We'll hire a front-end loader, and I don't know whose block of land it is, but we'll go in there we'll start on like Easter, Good Friday, and we'll whiz around it, and we'll make a nice track around this place. And then when everyone comes back to work on Tuesday, Wednesday, they won't even know what happened. So we did this, but this block of land actually had a hill in it, and it's just the way it was. So if it was flat, it would have been flat, but this little block of land had a hill in it. So we made this track, and we started working horses around it. And we didn't really know what we were doing, and we stuffed some up, and some went better, and some, like some went the same, some went better, some went worse. But over a period of 6-12 months, we were flying. And because everyone else was just sort of, just training that they'd trained for 100 years, we stuck out, and off we went. And that's how it all started.
So what is the, is it just get them fitter without, putting too much pressure on their legs, that sand, or what is the key to it?
I think the main thing is you just increase their, I think it's called what you call VO2 max. So you just increase their lung capacity. And the heart is a muscle like any other muscle, like a bicep or a tricep or a hamstring or something. And the stronger you make it, and the better you make their lungs, you train their lungs to be able to get rid of the lactic acid, because you get rid of your lactic acid through your breathing, I'm pretty sure. So yeah, the fitter you get them, it's just like anything. Just the more you do something, the better you'll get it, within reason. Obviously, there's a tipping point. We went past the tipping point on more than one occasion. But yeah, we just got better at it, and then we got better horses, and yeah, off we went.
I think Tim and I could maybe take some of that advice about increasing our VO2, Justin. We're aiming on that for sales. But Lindsay Smith is obviously...
To the point now, Charmaine, where I'm like addicted to it. I'm 53. But I have to work out at least 5 or 6 times a week, go and do something, whether it's a spin class at the gym or go and run up the stairs to the monument, or I'm just addicted to it. So I literally can't function unless I go and do something now.
Yeah, I used to be like that, Justin, but I don't know what changed for me, so I need to get back. And it is a good habit, because like you said, the more you use something, the fitter you get, the better you become. So it's true for all species, I think.
My gym membership's just gone up. I got the email yesterday. I haven't been for 12 months, but I'm still paying it, and I do intend to go.
The main thing is keep paying it. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, Tim, is your personal trainer still texting you, asking where you've been?
No, he gave up. I think he gave up. Fair enough.
Well, I still have a personal trainer. I'm down to once a week. I had her this morning. She's this beautiful little lady. Butter wouldn't melt in the mouth until you get in the gym with her. And, oh, my God, I think everyone should have a trainer once a week just to push you out of your comfort zone.
Yes, and definitely. Do something else. They're worth their weight in gold, just like horse trainers. Now, Justin,
well, I had a few too many beers last night, Charmaine, and there's no way I would have gone to the gym had I not have had a meeting with this little lady, Brooke, at 5 o'clock. And I thought of many ways of texting her saying, I can't make it, but I knew every time that she would come, she would know what I was up to. So I was like, oh, well, I went there, but I feel better for it. Yeah.
Well, hopefully she's not here listening, but at the same time, good work for getting Justin out of bed. Now, Lindsay's obviously moved to the east coast of Australia, to Warrnambool. Given you know him so well, what's it like knowing Lindsay?
Lindsay actually asked me to be partners in the Eastern States venture, and I nearly did, and I just thought, you know what, I just didn't have it. Probably the timing was wrong. Things weren't sort of going that well in for other parts of my life, and I was like, oh, yeah, you're probably better off going without me. So Lindsay went over there, and he's done super well. Yeah, and I always watch his horses and barrack for him. But if I sliding doors, if I went left instead of right, I wouldn't have been part of the show. But fortunately enough, he's done well without me.
Now, I did a bit of research. What I could find is your first thoroughbred runner was in April 2006, Most Wanted, I think the horse was called. But then your first winner wasn't until March 2011, called Rosie Rocket at Pinjarra.
Yeah, so one of the guys that I trained the paces for at the time asked me to train a horse for him, a thoroughbred, which I did. I think it had been racing up in the dirt somewhere. Anyway, it didn't go very well. And I was that busy with it was a pain because I was concentrating on the paces at the time. So I let my license lapse for however it was. It was about a decade, wasn't it? Or something like that.
Well, this says 2006, and then your first winner was Rosie Rocket 2011. So it's that sort of 5 years.
So then I come back, and fortunate enough, bumped into Rosie Rocket. Rosie Rocket found me. And that was good. Won a lot of money that day. $17 was a beauty.
Now, I did find an interview where you said you were trying to build a house at the time, probably didn't have the money. And can you sort of tell us part of that, the Rosie Rocket story, and how that successful plunge came off?
So we were moved down to this beautiful little part of the world, and one of our boundaries is the state forest with these beautiful sand hills that go forever, and then they're literally sand mountains, so they're almost too big. But there's a guy down there who pretty unique character. His name was Mike Morton, and he was helping me build my house pads and stuff like that. And he was a grano worker and a builder. He could literally turn his hand to anything. He's a real strong guy, Vietnam vet. Did a couple of tours of Vietnam, and he's a Kiwi guy, and he knew a fair bit about fitness. I think he played a couple of games representing New Zealand in rugby in France and things like that around the place. So he knew his fitness pretty well, and he was training his horse out there at the time, and my wife was riding it, and we had Rosie Rocket, and this horse that Mike Morton had was running seconds and thirds in Bunbury Cups and things like that at the time. And Rosie Rocket was a maiden, and my wife was only riding just the two horses to help him out. And then he would come out and help me build my house. And, cause I had this thing that I just wanted to build my own house one day. So that's what I was doing. And, halfway through building the house, I sort of worked out I'm at least 100,000 short. And I just happened to ask Carol one day with my wife when she was riding. She came in, she worked both the horses at the time. This other horse name was Peg's Pride. And then she hopped off and rode Rosie Rocket. And I was washing her down and I said to Carol, how does Rosie compare to Peg's Pride? And she said, Rosie's a better horse than Peg's Pride will ever be. Just sort of threw that comment at me. So I'm hosting the horse down. This is good. Going into a maiden in a couple of weeks' time, handy. So we lobbed this maiden, and it was if you ever go back and have a look at it, it was the weakest bunch of horses you've ever seen. And I'd never trained a winner, and I think we drew out wide, and they put up $17. And I thought, well, I'm $100,000 worth, like, short building a house. I might as well be $110,000. It doesn't really matter. Like, we're not going to be able to finish it. So here goes. Anyway, she got up. So happy days. I wasn't brave enough to back her straight out, so I only backed her each way. But we got the money, and with that money, I thought, how long has this been going on? This is on a Thursday, I reckon. I thought, this is super. So on the Saturday, they have in the, well, they used to before the computers and that are taken over, they have sporting notices in the paper on a Saturday. So I've got all this money, and I went down and bought the paper Saturday morning. I've got nothing to do. I was only training one or two horses at the time and build my house. So I look in the paper, I better buy another horse, you know. I better buy a city horse, because this one was only, you know, maiden in the country. I didn't realise she'd end up being Group 1 placed. But so I thought, I better buy another horse. So I pick up the paper, and there's a horse in there called Gumnut Guru. And I'd never heard. I didn't know much about the thoroughbreds at the time. I never heard about it. Anyway, I rang a couple of my punt mates up. And they said, yeah, that's all right. That'll be able to win a race for you in town. So I ended up buying him. He was $30,000. That was with some of the money that I won on the Thursday. And he won $300,000 in the next 12 months. So the house got finished, and the rest is history.
What a start. I guess there's probably no looking back from there. And certainly your records says you didn't with, you know, Black Tycoon came along, which, I looking at his form, probably a testament to your training ability, because he had sort of, you know, reasonable Kalgoorlie circuit form, but it wasn't, you know, Perth Cup form at the time.
Yeah, look, I'm a lucky guy. Things always happen for me somehow, somewhere. Things just happen. The right things come into my life. And with horses, when I first started off in the pacing, the first few horses I bought, a couple of them ended up being Group 1 winners. And when I started off in the thoroughbreds, the first horse that I got, like really when I was serious, was Rosie Rocket, who won a hell of a lot of money. And then obviously with the money she won, yeah, we got Gumnut Guru, Black Tycoon, and just really good horses always come into my life at the right time. They just do. So I said, I'm a lucky guy. And that, when Black Tycoon came along, he was just ideal. He'd broken down early. He obviously was a pretty expensive yearling, I think, at the time. He might have been 50,000 or 60,000. And then had broken down, did a tendon, I think, before he raced, had a few years off. I reckon he had 3 years off, and ended up finding his way to Kalgoorlie. So everyone now knows that the Black Fries took a long time to come good. So he had all the time to come good. Probably had a little injury early that, you know, put him off, was able to grow, and got well educated up in Kalgoorlie, and I got him at the right time, and off we went. We nearly won an Adelaide Cup. We got beat ahead, I think, in an Adelaide Cup. And backed him big that day too, 20-1. Anyway.
Hope you stuck to each way, your each way.
I did, bidding. But I still cried because it was a lot of money. But yeah, I did back him each way. Yeah.
I need to be braver like you, Justin. I'm more like a $1, $2 bet each way. I'm not.
Oh, you know, a bloke told me when I was about 25, or no, I was about 28, 30. Okay. He was a professional punter. And he said, I'll give you some advice. He said, make your minimum bet $1,000. And I was like, well, buckled at the knees, you know, what the, you know, he goes, well, he said, you won't have many of them, and you'll put a lot of thought into it when you do. And if you get beat, it'll really hurt, and you'll think about it. And I think it was one of the best advice I've ever had when it comes to punting.
So. I'm going to take that up.
Yeah. Hey? Tim, that's not going to be an excuse.
It's Albury this afternoon, and I'll be employing that strategy, I think.
Well, I basically stops you being a punter, so to speak. I'm not a punter, but when you have a bet, you have a bet.
Yeah.
We'll see how Tim is at the end of the day, if he's a happy punter or a sad punter. We'll see. we'll get to She's a Belter a bit later on, but you've had some good horses before her. So Material Man won 16 races, won a Belmont Sprint and a Perth Cup, was a runner-up in a Kingston Town Classic twice, and he also ran third in a Railway Stakes. Is it a case of what could have been?
He's just a ripper horse. Just a ripper. What could have been? I don't know. I think probably, it's probably a race he should have won. It was the Ore Stakes. That Lucy rode him, and she just probably didn't have the confidence, and it was a 1400 meter race, and he was fresh, and she just erred. And otherwise, he probably should have won that. I don't think he could have won the races here. The handicap races, you know, he carried top weight, And then we bumped into a couple of Bob Peters fillies that were carrying, I can't remember, it was 49 kilo or 50 kilo. Yeah, proper, really good Group 1 horses that went on. And just in this part of the world, the handicap races, it's tough. But he was as good a horse as that you would get. But he was probably, he would have had to have gone in 10 Group 1 races to win one. And if, yeah, he wasn't outstanding in that regard when it got to Group 1 level, but incredibly good horse around that Group 3 and Group 2 level. But yeah, probably the All Stakes is the one he probably should have won, but we, you know, it's like anything, we didn't. She rode him 11 out of 10 many times, and we won plenty of other races. But yeah, he was a great horse.
And Lucy, of course, is your daughter and highly successful WA jockey now. And Arcadia Queen was one of the Bob Peters fillies you spoke of, and of course she sold for 3.2 and, you know, champion in the East as well, so a bit unlucky there.
Yeah, so it was just a case of bumping into, you know, Bob Peters' horses were flying. They had the combination of Grant Williams, William Pike and Bob Peters, and it was pretty well, it was like bumping into Genghis Khan every Saturday, you know. It was just tough, so, and good luck to them, but they had it nailed. And I'd love to have a horse like him again. He was so much fun. He was just a great horse. He was a tiny little horse, and we had a lot of fun with him for sure.
Yeah. And another mare that you bought for just $10,000 in 2015, Key Lister, who ended up in the East Coast, on the East Coast. Yeah, did a great job with her and sold her for a lot of money.
Yeah, so sometimes horses just come into your life, and I remember the moment that I seen her in a stall down at Amelia Park. She was at, which is Peter Walsh's beautiful farm down at in Vass, a place called Vass near Busselton, and I was like, wow, you know, I'm buying this horse. You know, like she did have a fault. She was a little bit back on her knees, which obviously it's a terrible fault. I don't know whether I'd do it again, but. There were so many other parts to her to like. She had this, I don't know, these heads that these certain horses get, sort of a more of a gelding's head than a mare's head, and just beautifully put together. And I could see she'd be fast. So, and her breeding was fast. So I bought her despite the her faults, and it was a cheap, right, I think she was like 386 in a sale when things weren't going well in the breeding industry here. So, got it for 10 grand and she won 700 and something, and we sold it for 950. And that pretty well, that changes your life at that stage of my life, you know. So that sort of puts you on a different trajectory and off you go.
A share in success, shining a spotlight on ownership success stories.
Yeah, I hope you got a long time. It's a good story. sometimes in life, even when you try and stuff it up, things go your way, and this is one of those cases where I'd seen this filly at the sale, and she was by a stallion that I'd never heard of, but she was the most stunning looking horse that I'd seen for a long time, and I just loved her. And she was out of a family that I thought was pretty active, and there were some of the better horses that I'd seen here, like fillies, were out of her damn sister. So I really like this filly. And she was getting sold by a guy that I'd never seen him sell horses before. He's a pretty prominent breeder. And I thought, is this unusual for him to be selling? So I'd seen his horse and thought, okay, I really like it. I better stay away so that no one sort of knows what's going on. And it's gone in the ring to get sold. And as I said, I didn't want to show any interest. So I'm right up the back of the sale. And I, as good as I am at some things, I'm a little bit dyslexic sometimes, or a lot of the time. And I've looked up at the board, I'd say, and I've seen this horse come in. I've bought it 40 grand. Terrific. It's great. So I go back down to the sale, back down to where the horse is in the stall, and have a look at it. And I get the girls there to get out, walk it. And I'm happy as Larry. I've bought this horse, 40 grand. It's terrific. Anyway, a couple of days later, the lady that breaks my horses in rings me up and she says, I've got those two horses you bought. One's a really nice filly. And I don't know what you were thinking when you bought that colt, but I don't like it much. And I said, no, I didn't buy any colts, I just bought two fillies. So she said, all right, well, it must be a guy called Colin Webster. She breaks his horses. And she said, but it's not the kind of horse he'd buy either. So anyway, 2 days later, she rings me up. She says, now that colt's yours. I said, no, I didn't buy any colts. So while I'm on the phone to her, I get my phone up and I'm looking through the results. And look at me, I've bought lot 59. And she was lot 60. And my blood's run cold. And I look at the photo of this thing of 59, and it's nothing that I would buy, you know. So, sort of like Danny DeVito compared to Arnold Schwarzenegger in the Twins movie. So I thought, what the hell on earth? I rang up Magic Millions, and they went, no, you bought like 59. The other horse is passed in. So it's gone back down to Denmark, which is 4 or 5 hours south of Perth, back on the farm. I was going through a divorce at this stage, so I'm broke. I shouldn't have been buying horses anyway. I was flare feeding and fly blowing. So, far out. Well, I said, what does he want for it? He said he wants 50 grand. I said, oh, no. I've already bought the one I don't want for 40. My limit was 40, and he wants 50. So I hung up, and I just felt sick. Like, honestly, I felt sick. I looked at the photo of this horse again and went, oh, no way. So I rang him back up and said, actually, it took a few days. And we ended up, I said, just give him 40 grand, see if we'll take the 40. Seeing I just went on for a few days and it didn't. And then I was just like, I said, Magic Millions. I said, listen, I haven't got any money anyway to pay for it, so don't send me a bill for it. But just put it down to me. I'll buy it. But I don't know when I can pay her. I just don't know. And that was, she's a belter. So, as I said, I did try and stuff it up many times. And luckily enough, no one bought it. And it was, I bought the wrong one and it was passed in. It sat in the paddock for a week and I was still able to get hold of it.
And of course, you sent it to Luke Fernie, who did a great job with her in Perth, and then realised, you know, a bit like Key Lister and some of the other good horses you sent across to the Snowdens.
Yeah, so I don't know what really, I was just 100% certain that after she won the Magic Millions, I sort of looked at it all and went, right, I was probably lucky because Amelia's Jewel was the one that won the Karakata that year. So I looked at, she hadn't raced at that stage. I looked at it and thought, well, you're probably going to win the Karakata. That's 300,000, the winner or something similar. But it's really about, we need to stake you to win a group race on the East Coast so we can sell you at some stage. And it's all about if you win the Magic Millions here and you won the Karakata, you're probably not going to be worth any more than if you won both and if you just won one as a broodmare. So we're better off to get you out of here. And I had no idea she'd win a group one race, but I was hoping that you could just go over there and be under the nose of the people that breed over there. There was also a horse over there, one of her, I can't think of his name, he's by demerit. He won $1 million that was out of that family, just won in Sydney the month before. I can't not think of his name off the top of my head. So I was like, we need to get you out of here and get you over the East Coast and see what you can do. And I had no idea that the Snowdens would do what they did, or she would do what she did.
And of course, it's sort of paid off now. It was the JJ, I think she won, and you know, basically
won the sires, then the JJ Atkins, yeah,
and probably guarantees she's, well, the way the mare market is now, probably worth $1 million, you'd think. So, and she's still at the time of recording, she's still racing at the moment, Justin.
Yeah, I think she's trialing on Monday, and then she's set for the Cats Tiara in Queensland is her main mission, this preparation. So I think she'd nearly won 2 million, 1.9 or something like that, 1.8, I can't remember. But, great. As good a horse as you could ever wish to get.
What I'm taking out of this interview, Justin, is you've got to back yourself with serious money and conviction on your horses that you buy into, and touch wood, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, well, I think if you... you have to have some skin in the game. So there's lots of people buy lots of horses for lots of people. But I think there's nothing like having a good share or owning your own horse or having a good share in one. And when you get it right, which you will, you'll get it right eventually, make enough. I've bought plenty of horses that I wish I'd never seen. So I know when I see them, I don't want those ones. But when you see the right one, it definitely can bear fruit, that's for sure.
I take it lot 59 never reached any great heights.
No, I think about a week after I bought it, it went through about five fences at the breakers and got a vet bill more than it was worth, and I ended up putting in the clearance sale. I think I got $4,000 for it, so it's just like, get out of my life. Your best loss is your first loss. Just get out if we're done. Yeah.
I met you, Justin, obviously, the Quokka and that whole Western trilogy in April, and that was a great thing. And as we've touched on, you've been in the trots and successfully in the thoroughbreds, but you also dabbled in the now breeding a few dogs.
I'm having a ball with the dogs. Captured for race last night at Sandown, got beat a nose. So it's something I always wanted to do. I had a nice farm, and I always wanted to breed a litter of greyhounds or at least get involved in it. And as I went through a marriage split, and my wife was never that keen. I did mention it a few times, and she was like, "Nah, I've got enough to do." So obviously, I went through a bit of a life changing experience. So thought, here's an opportunity, and ended up meeting Linda Britton and Chris Health, who were obviously Linda's, Robert Britton's sister, and their dad, Alan. They're all Hall of Famers, they're all superstars when it comes to greyhounds, and got involved with them and was able to secure a couple of bitches that we breed together, and bred a couple of litters. Actually, just had our third litter born, I think we're about 21 days old now. And I'm having a ball, meeting lots of new people, going to places that I wouldn't have thought of, and having a great time, and actually having a lot of success. So we had a winner in a couple of placings this week already, and got one running around in Group 1 races, couch surfer. Yeah, it was a really good time.
At the Western Trilogy in the three slot races culminating in the Quokka, someone told me you told them that, in the old days, the trots people didn't talk to the gallops people, and the dogs sort of sat by themselves, but you thought it was a very inclusive, really great thing for WA racing in general.
Yeah, I think so. I think, I'm 100% certain, actually. We've all got the same disease. It's, you've all got the addiction. It's racing. And the same people that are, it's just a different version, whether you've got greyhounds or thoroughbreds or harness. And when I was a kid growing up, it was very segregated, and not many mixed, especially the greyhound people were, they sort of stuck to themselves. And now it's very inclusive, I think, that's with we've got a government body here called RAWA, which Racing Wagering West Australia, which governs the three codes. And I thought the other day, with all the slot races put together and everyone put in the one room, it's brought everyone very close together. And I think heading forward, unity is strength. So the it's very healthy heading forward. And I think it's great that everyone's all on the same page, and everyone sort of follows. Most people follow all the codes a lot more than has ever happened before.
Now, I walked through the Gloucester Park gates with you. A lot of people, even if you don't follow the trots, would know Gloucester Park, from watching the cricket at the Wacker. I certainly did. There'd be a race going on in the background. You'd be watching Ricky Ponting, smashing one to the boundary, or Shane Warne, getting a wicket or two. So it is a well-known track. But what was it like walking back through those gates for the first time in about 15 years?
Yeah, it was like going back to high school. When you go, if you ever go back to the high school after you left and you hadn't been there for a long time, or you, and um, yeah, it was a bit eerie. Had a good time. I'll probably go back there. It won't be 15 years between there and the next time I go there, but it was good to go back. And it's like it never even happened. Obviously, it took a lot of energy and that to be the leading trainer and leading driver and that kind of thing. And I look at it now and go, how did I even do it? So I suppose you've got to have the want and the desire, which does wane after a period of time. But it was good fun to go there, and good to see a lot of the old faces. The faces were all a lot older. They're all the same faces. They're all a lot older. But it was good fun, and the racing was good. And I've actually owned a couple of paces at the moment. I had a winner the other day at in Melton. It was called Wine Gum. Andrew Gaff trains for me, so I'm still involved in it.
We did touch on your daughter Lucy earlier. There is a lot of family involvement in racing, particularly the trots. Tell us a little bit about that.
Probably out of all the things that I've done in racing, I get the most satisfaction out of sort of watching Lucy. Well, obviously, I suppose most people would do that out of their kids, but watching their kids do it. But I think that one of the biggest achievements that I've done in racing is help Lucy get to where she did. Obviously, she has to be very disciplined to do what she does nowadays. But just those early steps to get a young woman from, get the confidence up, and probably used a lot of the mistakes that I've made early doors, try not to get her to repeat them. And she did. She listened very well. So I get a hell of a lot of enjoyment out of watching Lucy race. But probably like most people that have their kid as a jockey, will be very happy the day she retires as well.
That was going to be one of my questions. We know it's a very dangerous sport, and are you a good viewer of, as an owner even, are you a good, most trainers probably don't like other trainers training their horses, but you obviously do. Are you a good owner and viewer of racing?
I'm a good owner. I've had plenty of shit owners along the way to know what I shouldn't be, and I've had plenty of very good owners. So obviously I trained horses for 30 years, so you're going to have be exposed from one to the other. I try and be a good owner, and I try and just be aware. I try and be over it all. I can't not. My brain never stops, so I'm trying to be over it all and cover all the bases. But the bottom line is the trainer has to make the last decision, and the trainer has to want to please the owner, and the horse has to like the environment it's in. So it's a combination, and sometimes I'll move horses from one stable to another, but it's not that I don't like the trainer, and I try and explain to the trainer that I'm moving the horse for this reason. I'm going to give you another horse, but I think this horse will be better suited there or there or there or whatever, for whatever reason. And I'm only sort of new at it, 2 years, I think. I've been sort of not training, so, and having other people train the horses. But it is a business, and it does need to add up at the end of the day. And when you give someone a horse to train, as I said, it's because you like them as a trainer. That horse mightn't suit them super well. So you sort of need to explain to them that it's, there'll be another horse coming. We'll just need to keep going through it. So I try and be a good owner, obviously pay all my bills and the rest of it. And it is a union when a trainer trains a horse for you. You are a team. And whoever rides them or drives them or whatever, you are a team, all of you. So you all need to try and pull in the same direction and back everyone up and give everyone as much support and confidence as you can.
I think we're nearing the end.
Was that a long winded?
No, we really appreciate your time. But one last question. Do you think we'll ever see JT Warwick back in the training ranks?
No, you never say never, but Lucy trained a winner for me on Wednesday at quite a promising horse. Actually, I bought her the same day as I bought She's a Belter, and I had the option when I went through the marriage split of, I knew I couldn't keep both. I could only keep one financially. So I kept this other horse. So I thought she was better than she's a belter. So the other one just got a maiden the other day. What's her name? I Love Your Smile. So Lucy trains for me now. So I'd rather help someone else than do it myself. I literally don't have the, I don't have the desire and I don't want the commitment. I'd rather have the freedom to do what I want to do and someone else train the horse. So in a, you never say never, but at the moment, probably not. And on the East Coast, there's guys like Peter Snowden and Paul Snowden and obviously many others that are very good trainers that I can give them the horse and I can do whatever I want. And I know that full well that there's no one in the world that's going to be looking after that horse better than they are.
I think we'll call it time there. We really appreciate you giving up your morning straight after the gym, Justin, and you've given us a lot of great insights, some tremendous stories, and I certainly look forward to getting back across to WA, and I'm sure I'll shout you a drink there at one of those events, either at the Quokka or the Pinnacles or somewhere along the line. We certainly owe you a meal or something, and catch up and hear a few more stories that perhaps can't be broadcast.
Hopefully, my horses are winning and I can buy you, or my horses and my dogs are winning and I can buy you the beer.
Sounds good.
Thank you, Justin. It's been greatly appreciated. Thanks, Cameron.